It can be me.
Okay, ready to start? Okay, today's topic is Geneva's Das. We're going to go a little bit off the page. The simon in Shulchan Aruch that deals with Geneva's Das is not bound, interestingly enough, in Hilchos Geneva Gezeil. It's bound in the Halachos of Ono Mekartos, in Simon Shim Reish Chofes, starting with Reish Chofes Devov. So what is Geneva's Das? So there are a lot of different treatments of Geneva's Das because it comes up a lot nowadays, both in a business setting and in a personal setting. A lot of people write about it and so forth. So I saw one nice description in an article by somebody named Heshi Friedman that it's two things. Number one, creating a false impression, deception. Number two, engendering undeserved goodwill. And the truth of the matter is, these really break down the two different aspects of Geneva's Das because one is in the realm of Mekach, and the other is in the realm of just the social and personal interactions. And they're divided accordingly into two different sugyas in the Gemara. One sugya is in the Gemara in Chulin, Daf Tzadi Dalet. That is the sugya that calls Geneva Das by name and deals with some of the more famous cases of Geneva Das, person opening up a barrel of wine that has already been sold to a merchant, and a guest thinks that, or might think that it's being opened up in his honor, and some of the other famous scenarios of Geneva Das. But there's also the Sugya of Bava Messiah from Daf Ches, Daf Samech, that deals with the Geneva Das in more of a Mecha Chumemker type of scenario, where a person is mixing in good fruit and bad fruit and selling it all as good fruit, is mixing water and wine and selling it all as wine, is coloring his avodim that are for sale to make it look as if they are younger in age. These are the Mecha Chumemker scenarios of Geneva Das. And interestingly enough, if you look in the Shulchan Aruch and Simon Reish Chofes, Shulchan Aruch puts them all together, that they are mixed as one unit, starting with the case scenarios that are in Maseches Chulin, then going on to the case scenarios which are found in Maseches Bava Metzia. I believe, I don't know if you all received it, but I gave out a Mar Mekomos sheet, I think that Ari circulated it, right? You received it. I know that it was requested that we have Mar Mekomos sheets. And I gave the example two Mishnayos and Bava Metzia Daf Samech Amud Aleph that really give the Mekach HaMemker case scenarios. Now, if you look in the Maharsha in the Sugya and Maseches Chulin, so the Maharsha eases on one of the cases, which is that you shouldn't sell a shoe, a leather, to make a leather for a shoe, based on the assumption that it comes from a shkuta, because the shkuta is generally better quality than if it was a behema that was a trefa. If it was not a shkuta, then it's possible that it also could have been, you know, if it was from a mesa, then it would be potentially poisonous. But the Maharsha says that if we were dealing with a fraud, where somebody sold an item that was really worth $10 for $100, so that's Geneva Mamash. Why are we calling it Geneva's Das? So he says we're talking about a case where it sold for the appropriate value. In other words, the seller is representing that it's really worth a lot more, but he's selling it for the amount that it is genuinely worth. So there's no Hefstein Mamon involved. But rather, we're talking about what is referred to as Geneva's Das B'dvarim. It's Geneva's Das just with words alone, but without monetary consequences. So that seems to be the general theme of the cases that are in Maseches Chulin. But the Gemara brings the Maamar of Shmuel, who says, also the Gnom Das B'vrius, the Filu Akum, that you're not allowed to engage in this type of Geneva. It's Mashma. That whether it's in a Mecca context, or whether it's in what we might call a Matana context, that it is, it's awesome, both for Jews and for non-Jews. Now the Rambam has these halachos in two different places. One he has in Hilchos Deos, where the Rambam has in the Perek Beis, the halach above, cases, a number of the cases that are brought in Masechus Chulin. And then the Rambam also has in Perek Yud Ches of Hilchos Mechila, where the Rambam brings more of the Bava Mesiyah type cases, but in both cases, the Rambam says that what is the Aser, that is Aser Lignav Das Abrius, and the Rambam emphasizes Afilu Vidvarim. The Pashuk Shad of the Rambam is that the Rambam does not distinguish in terms of the din of Shmuel, that is, Gnevis Das is Aser, both with respect to Jews and with respect to non-Jews, between the different types of cases, although there are some. We have a different reading in the Rambam. The Rambam uses the Lashon very explicitly in Hilchos Mechila, where he says, Afilu Bidvarim, even if there wouldn't be any types of monetary consequences. So, if you look at the various Mekolas, you can really break down, I think, the cases of Gnevas Das into three categories. Two that extend to three. One is Shalol Ramos the Mecha Chomemker, that you can't deceive anybody in Mecha Chomemker transactions, with monetary consequences or without. Second is Shalol Lignam Das Abiyas Tafilu Bidvarim, as the Ramam's Lashon is, that even if it was just like the Gemara has the case of you invite somebody to come for a Su'udah, but you don't really have in mind that the person will accept. You're only inviting them because you know that they're not going to be able to come. So that also is included. And the third is also in the realm of Mekach u'Memker, and this is stated explicitly. You look in the Lashon of the Torah, the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch, they all say very, very clearly that it's not only that there is an obligation and not to deceive anybody when it comes to commerce, but rather in addition, if there is a blemish with respect to the item of merchandise, there is an affirmative obligation to inform any potential purchaser of any mum which exists in a mekach. And this is an extremely significant halachic detail because, as many the commentaries have pointed out, in the general secular olam, we have a principle of caveat emptor, or buyer beware, that it's almost the responsibility of the buyer to spot any blemishes. We have an affirmative obligation to point out any blemishes whatsoever if somebody is selling an item of merchandise. It's a very nice story. If you look in the first volume of the Magid Speaks series, so page 66, it tells the story of Rav Elia Kohen Dishnitzer, who was according to the Chazon Ish, one of the Lamed Bavnikim. And he owned an orchard, and he desperately needed money, but he couldn't sell the orchard because whenever a purchaser would come, he would point out all the flaws of the orchard. And even if the purchaser would push and push and say, no, I really don't care about this floor or that floor, he said, no, but you don't know about this other floor. Or he had the one American purchaser, and he said, the Gemara Bava Metzia Daf Chav Tes says that if you're far away from your field, then it's going to be a sour investment because you won't be able to keep your eyes on it. And when the person wanted to go forward anyway, he saw that the potential purchaser was pulling out a box of pills from his pocket, and he said, well, why are you taking these pills? And the purchaser said, oh, because I have a heart condition. So the purchaser said, well, forget it, then all bets are off. This is a very stressful orchard to maintain, and I don't want to impair your health in any way. So therefore, he refused to sell the orchard. This is mamish, the opposite of the ethic which is out there in the marketplace, which is to make the deal all solely for your benefit and, if possible, for the detriment of the purchaser, because this way you get the better deal. But that's the idea. Is not only affirmative, it's also passive, that there is an obligation to see to it that that the purchaser is not harming himself and is aware of all of the movement, aware of all of the blemishes. You disclose all the blemishes and the person wants to buy anyway. That's a different story. But you have an obligation to disclose all of the blemishes. What's the fundamental yesod of Gnevas Das? The Rashi writes in the Masechus Chulin that in a case where a Jew is selling a non-Jew a piece of meat and is creating the impression that the Gitter Nasha has been taken out, but it wasn't taken out, So it doesn't matter, you know, how kashrus wise to a non-Jew to eat a nashach. Okay, no yoku b'nei, so a skin and nashach. Only Jews are not allowed to eat a skin and nashach. But he thinks that the Jewish merchant is doing something very nice, that he's only selling a piece of meat that would be eligible to Jews as well. So he would think he would react favorably to that gesture of kindness. So says Rashi, what's the problem? Nimsa Maxik lo tova bechinam. That's the idea. You're engendering undeserved goodwill. Nimsa maxik lo tova bechinam. It's not necessarily a monetary value per se, but it is a social value. It is a friendship value that you are securing improperly, that you haven't earned. We have various times in Tanakh where this lashon is used. The Lavan speaks about a tignovis levavi when he's complaining to Yaakov, and Rashi says ganaftis dati, where it says that Avshalom, Yitvatignov Avshalom is Lev Anshe Yisrael, that Avshalom was almost the paradigm of Geneva's Das. It's what's pointed out in the Medrash Rav and Parshas Vayeshev with respect to the Achi Yosef, where it says, Lo Yochu Dabu L'Sholom, that his brothers weren't able to speak with him peacefully, so Rashi compliments them, that they weren't Echad Bepev, Echad Belev, that they were consistent, at least they didn't pretend to be friendly to him on the outside. They made it clear to him that they detested him for the dreams that he told them about. And this is contrasted with Avshalom, who was out to kill Amnon for the rape of Tamar, and he acted towards Amnon like he was his best buddy, and then he arranged to have him killed. So that was what Avshalom was all about. Avshalom was about Geneva's Das. So Avshalom was supposed to be sequestered in a particular location, wasn't supposed to go up to Yerushalayim. He made up some story that he had to bring a korban or whatever, and he got permission to go up, and he told everybody, I got the permission that I'm going to come up and I'm going to be the ruler, and he tricked everybody into joining a cheering squad of soldiers and supporters at a major movement based on committing an act of Geneva's Das. So these are cases where we find this principle very, very clearly articulated. Is it a Daraisa principle? We have these Daraisa precedents. Is it something that we actually derive from a lot in the Torah? So according to the Ritva in Masechus Chulin and Daf Tzadi Dal, the answer is yes. The Ritva says that we derive it from a Parshas Kedoshim, where it says, Lo Tignovu, says the Ritva, includes not only Geneva's Mon, but includes Geneva's Das. And it's clear that it applies, he says, to Jews and non-Jews, because the Trop, this is why Trop is so important when you're laying, is Lo Tignovu, it's not the right, and then it says, Lo Tishachashiv, Lo Tishachashiv, Lo Tishachashiv, Lo Tishachashiv, right? It says, Lo Tishachashiv, Lo Tishachashiv, Ishbamiso. So he says, since it's the Ishba Amiso is only going on Lo Tishachashu, below Tishakiru, it's not going on Lo Tignovu, because that finishes within a snafka. We see that's not only something which is limited to Ishba Amito, that is something which is applicable to everybody. So this day he gives as the Daraisa source. The Uraim also says it's Daraisa, the Tosefta, and Baba Kamma, Perek Shvi, seems to indicate that it's Daraisa as well, because the Tosefta says that there are a whole bunch of different types of Genevos, Vigado Shevikulam, and the one which is the absolute worst, the absolute most abominable type of Genevo, is Geneva's Das. And it's bunched together with the Geneva's Mammon, which is clearly a Daraisa. Now, the Ritva then seems to hold that the source of Geneva's Das is Mamash Geneva, meaning whatever is the source of Geneva's Mammon, Lo Tignovu, that's the source of Geneva's Das. You may have seen Bisporno, who actually says that the pasuk of Lo Tignov in the Aseres Tzedivos in Parshas Yisrael comes to include Geneva's Das as well in his reading. So it's consistent with the idea that it's included within Lo Tignov, it's included within Lo Tignov. Now the Shari Tshuva, which is in Chelek Yemel Simen Kuf Pei Dalet, the Shari Tshuva seems to subsume Geneva's Das in the realm of the Issel Shakir. And he says that this is considered to be, like the Tosefta says, the Gadol Shebekulam, the worst type of Geneva, for the reason that if you have a Sfas Sheker, the Sfas Sheker is the Ashma Rabba, it's considered to be a giant Simnis Chayavnu, Al Gidrei HaEmes, Ki Hu Yisod HaNefesh. He says that reason for the Geneva's Das is so severe is precisely because it is the antithesis of Emes, because we're supposed to guide ourselves with the Midos of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and for some shall HaKadosh Baruch Hu Emes, and when we engage in Geneva's Das, it's the most invidious type of activity that we can commit, because we're mamash, we're fooling each other. And that's the reason he says that Shayach La'akum as well, because it runs the Midos. Recall that this is a similar type of argument that we quoted last time, in the name of Minchas, the Minchas Tinoch, to explain why, in his opinion, Geneva in general is something which would be a-asur-bein, whether it's done to a Yisrael, or whether it's done to a non-Yisrael, even if you would hold a Gezel Akku, might not be asur mitzoraisa, according to those shitas, which we don't hold like. But he says, Geneva's Akku for sure is asur mitzoraisa. What's the reason? Because this is not just a question of, are you allowed to be mechasim mamon chavera, which is more or less the definition of Gezela, but this runs to midos. It's a mita grua to stealthily steal something from somebody. So it's the same idea that the Shari Shuva is expressing with respect to Geneva's Das, to fool somebody, to convey a deceptive false impression. So this is something which is a terrible mita. It's a terrible character trait, and that's the reason why it would be Oster. Is there some type of an afkamina, whether I would learn that the source of the Isser is based on Lo Tignovu, or whether the source of the Isser is based on Isser L'Shaker. So I'll tell you, one of the major authors who talks about Geneva's Das in the modern age, I should bring him in because he was a Rebbe of mine as well, certainly one of the great teachers here at YU, is Rabbi Aaron Levine. Dr. Aaron Levine, Zichrono Livracha. So he wrote, if you look in any book that he wrote, and he has, you know, at least one chapter devoted to Geneva's Das, and some of the later chapters he has extensive case studies where he discusses theoretical discussions that implicate issues of Geneva's Das. And he suggests two possible chilukim as to whether it's derived from the Isser Lo Tignovu, whether it's derived from the Isser L'Shaker, Rosh Sheker Tzilchak, etc. But first, let's just go over some of the classical cases that are mentioned in Gemara and Gulin so that we can understand the Chilukim a little bit better. So, as I said, the Gemara and Baba Metzia, and Mishnayos of Baba Metzia talk about mixing merchandise and not admitting it. The three cases I'll spell out in the Gemara and Gulin, though, you know, there are a few more, but these are kind of like three defining cases. One is where there's a piece of trade meat in the marketplace, and an announcement is made. The Gemara talks about making a hachraza in the marketplace. In certain places, they would make a hachraza so that the Jews would know that there's trade meat that they have to avoid buying. They say, Nafal bistro l'bnei chela. They're saying that there's meat which is available for the b'nei chela. Who were the b'nei chela? They were the soldiers, the non-Jewish soldiers who were quartered in town, meaning that there's meat now. So some of the meat that's being sold right now is not kosher meat. So you have to be careful. Some of the meat that's being sold is meat which could be eaten by non-Jews. It's nafal bisra l'bnei chela. And the Gemara discusses that, is that a clear enough lashon? And when you say nafal bisra l'bnei chela, maybe you should say nafal trefa l'bnei chela, that the meat that has become available is mamish treif, because bisra just sounds like it's meat. And maybe not everybody would necessarily know that the bistra means that it is trefa, that it is trefa meat. So the Gemara says, "Leima nafal trefasa libnei chela." So the Gemara says, but then nobody would buy it. Nobody would buy it if you say nafal trefasa libnei chela, because then it sounds like you're saying this disgusting rancid meat that was torn up had a physiological had a physiological defect. That's what a trafe is, a physiological defect. So even though it's not injurious to eat for a non-Jewish person, but it just doesn't sound so good. So nobody's going to buy it. So the Gemara says, yeah, but then if you don't say nafal trefasa, so maybe they'll make a mistake and they think they're getting kosher meat, and therefore it's Geneva's Das on some level. So the Gemara says no, because they should know better. In other words, this is like a term of art. Inuhu kimetal nafshayu, they would be making the mistake themselves if they drew that conclusion, because it's like a standard term of art. You're not going to refer to the meat as something which is disgusting. You'll just indicate it's not kosher. So you'll use some sort of a euphemistic term, nafal bisra l'bnei chela, and everybody in the market kind of gets it. And if they didn't get it,
then they would end up being angry, and they would express that anger and so forth. So from the market conditions, and from the fact that this is what is always done and nobody gets upset, this is the proof that the term of Nafal Bisra is understood by the non-Jewish population. That's one case. Another case is what we mentioned earlier briefly, is Psichas Chavis, that it was considered to be a very big honor if you would open up a barrel of wine for a guest, because once the barrel would be opened up, then it would spoil more quickly, and the fact that it was opened up in honor of a particular guest is considered that you're forfeiting your own monetary future for the sake of honoring this guest, so it creates a very favorable impression. But if the barrel was already sold to a merchant, so it would have been opened up for that purpose, and the owner of the barrel doesn't have to worry about it going bad, because the merchant's going to pick it up the next day anyway, so he's going to take out a little bit of wine now for a guest and open it up, the guest will feel tremendously honored. But the reality is that the host didn't really do anything. So the Gemara indicates that the host is obligated to make it clear to the guest that the barrel was already sold to a merchant, so that the guest will not be machzik tova to the owner b'chinam. And the Gemara then talks about a case where Rav Yehuda had Ula over, and Rav Yehuda opened up the barrel for Ula, but it had already been sold to a chenvani, and the Gemara says, how could he have done that? The Gemara has two answers. One is, he told Ula, and the other answer is, well, he would have opened it up for Ula anyway, so therefore he didn't have to tell him, even though it was actually sold to a merchant. La halacha, the second answer that's given that indicates that if he would have done it anyway, he wouldn't have to tell him, is not quoted in the classical works of halacha. It does not appear in the Torah, doesn't appear in the Rambam, that particular answer. And the question is, why doesn't it appear? So the Beis Yosef says it doesn't appear because it's pashut, because it's a dove of pashut. But not everybody thinks that it's a dove of pashut. The Lecha Mishnah thinks, so maybe it doesn't appear because we don't paskin that way. So that's also an important nekuda. Then we'll get back to it. And the fourth famous case is Mar Zutra, who's walking from Sakara to Mechuzah, and Rav and Rav Safra are walking in the opposite direction to Sakara. They meet midway. Mar Zutra thought that Rav and Rav Safra were there as his welcoming party, and he says, oh, wow, thank you so much for coming out to greet me. That is really such a tremendous honor. And the question was, do they have an obligation to disabuse them of this impression? So Rav Safra said, well, we weren't really coming out in your honor, but had we known that you were coming, we would have come anyway. And Rav says to Rav Safra, why did you have to tell him such a thing? We have no obligation to inform him. And the Gemara says, why wouldn't you have an obligation to inform? In the case of the barrel, is an obligation to inform. So the answer is, here, it was an unreasonable inference that Mar Zutra made that the Rabbanim were going out to welcome him. It's a reasonable inference if somebody goes through the trouble of opening up a barrel. Not everyone sells it to merchants, that they do a lavishing honor upon the guest, and therefore that type of thing has to be corrected. That type of impression has to be corrected. But that somebody would be walking on the derech and come across other people who are walking in the opposite direction to come to the conclusion that those other rabbis were going out to honor him, Zutra's assumption was not warranted, and therefore the Gemara indicates, based on what Rava says, that there's no obligation to correct that misimpression. So let's move on now. So we'll get back to some of the applications of these cases. So let's move on now to Rabbi Aaron Levine's two suggestions, interesting suggestions. He says, well, in some of these cases, there isn't clear kavana on the part of the person, on the part of the one who's conveying the false impression, to actually convey a false impression. Like, it's not necessarily the case, at least according to simple reading of the Gemara, that when the barrel of wine is being opened, that the person has in mind to convey the impression that he's being mechaved the guest. It could be that he didn't have that in mind per se. That's a question. Rashi says it's only in Isser if he actually had it in mind. But certainly in the case of the rabbis who are walking the derech, they didn't intend to convey a false impression. So if there is no intention to convey a false impression, and yet nonetheless we see that there are scenarios in the Gemara where we say that it would be considered to be Geneva's Das, So remember that we quoted last time the Ksos, in Siman Lamed Daled, where the Ksos says that when it comes to Gezela, that there is no Isser, that somebody cannot commit the prohibition of a Gezela if they do it for Shogig, if they do it unintentionally, right? So therefore, says suggests Rabbi Levine, that according to the Ksos, the foundation of Geneva's Das has to be not Geneva, but has to be Sheker. That's what he makes. So that's what he suggests within the Ksos. The other suggestion that he makes is that within the case, the answer that was given to explain the case of Rav Yehuda and Ula, where there was a question, how could Rav Yehuda have opened up the barrel of wine for Ula when he had already sold it to the merchant? So the second answer, which is not for the halacha, at least not in the Ratzua, not in the Rambam, not in the Shulchan Aruch, it's okay in that case, since Rabbi Yehuda would have extended this honor to Ula anyway. So if the problem is a problem of Geneva, since a false impression is actually being, let's assume not like the Ksos for a second, but since a false impression is actually being conveyed, so even if Rabbi Yehuda knew in his own mind that he would have extended this courtesy to Ula anyway, it could still be a problem, an objective problem of a Geneva, but it wouldn't be an objective problem of Sheker, because it's no longer Sheker that he's being mechabed Ula by opening up the barrel, because the reality is that even if he hadn't sold it to the merchant, he would have opened up the barrel anyway. Now, one could suggest that maybe this also relates to the actual machlokas between Rashi and Tosfos, going back to the barrel case, that we can understand Rashi's shita, that Rashi says that there's only a problem that in the case of opening up a barrel for somebody, if the one opening up the barrel is explicitly, like through his amira, conveying the impression that he is looking to provide honor to the guest by virtue of opening up the barrel. It's only when he says "Kishomelo Vishpilcha Ani Posfan." Okay, that's only then is there a problem of Geneva's Das. And Tosfos says that's not the mashmos. It's not the mashmos of the sugya, like the case of Rabbi Yehuda and Ula. It wouldn't be anything to discuss. He says that you know for sure. Rabbi Yehuda would not have lied to Ula about the fact that he also had consigned the barrel to the local merchant. So it must be that even without Amira, even when it's not an explicit statement, that there would be a problem of Geneva's Das. So it could be that according to Rashi, the underpinning of the Yisra really is Sheker Mamish, and therefore there has to be some sort of a Maisa of Shekris, while according to Tosfos, no, the problem is simply that there's an impression, there's a false impression which is being created, which is a form of Geneva that is emerging based upon that false impression. Okay, now we mentioned the two different approaches of the Ritva and the Rabbeinu Yonah and the Shari Tshuva regarding whether the source is Lotik Novu, whether the source of the Issur Geneva Das would be Geneva Mamish, or whether the source is that of Sheker. It's important to note that there are those, including the Bach and the Smak, who are of the opinion that when the nature of the Geneva Das does not lead to an actual loss of Mamun, in which case it would be Geneva Mamish, right? That it's only Midah Rabbanan in nature altogether. The Bach says this explicitly in Siman Reish Chofetz. He says that, like in the case of the Lo Yisarev Adam Machavero, that you shouldn't give the impression you want someone to be your guest when you really are only doing it because you know they're not going to show up. That this type of thing where there's no real monetary consequence would be only Midah Rabbanan. What would be a nafkamina as to whether it would be Deraisa or Derabbanan? So there's a nice sefer called Nips Vasayim that deals with a lot of these issues. It was written by Rav Nachum Yab Rub in Eretz Yisrael, published, I think it was republished maybe around 5 years ago or so. He suggests that you might have suffix scenarios, or where there's a question whether we paskin that a certain thing is Geneva's Das or is not Geneva's Das, that if we would paskin the Rabbanan, so then there would be more room to go to Kula. Like, for example, one area which is quoted often, I think, not precisely, where there is a machlokis is in the realm of matana. Is Gedevas Das only in the context of Mecher, or is it also in the context of matana? Famous Shach, also Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, that says it does not apply to matana. The Shach is talking about also you're selling an animal to a non-Jew who doesn't need for it to be a properly shepherded animal, but you're selling it pretending that it's shepherded, that it's a shepherded animal, and it's really not a properly shepherded animal. So he says, well, that's a problem. This is the Shach in Simikuf Yud Zayin of Yerodea, Sifkot and Yud Gimel. But he says, oh, well, you look at the Shulchan Aruch, Lashon of the Shulchan Aruch, he says, it's also Linkor, but if it would be Matanah, so that would be perfectly okay. And Rabbeinu Tam is quoted by the Rosh, and Hulin is indicating Matanah. So, as opposed to, you often find in some contemporary discussions, a discussion of how, oh, if it's Matanah, it might not be Ganeva's Das altogether. The truth of the matter is, I think the Shach and the other Shitas, Rabbeinu Tam and others, are arguing about a nekuda as to whether matana Gedevas Das is applicable to matana for an akum. I don't think that there is much of an issue with respect to Yisrael, because the classic case of inviting somebody for a meal, it seems to be a case of matana. But nonetheless, whether it's a question ben Yisrael the chaver, or whether it's a question ben Yisrael la akum, there's some sort of a machlokis in the matana context. So he says, oh well, it could be then that there would be room to be mekel if you held that Ganeva's Das is only Midrabanan, or if you hold that it's only Midrabanan in this particular context. If you hold that whenever there's only Ganeva's Das, that it can only be Midrabanan, so then maybe there's room to say that in those applications, which we're not sure whether it would be us or not, there might be some room to be mekel. Lemaisa, we don't really, the pashtus, especially in the Rambam, who makes a point of saying that even when you're dealing with Dvarim be'alma, that also we know Das Fabrios, the Lashon of Shmuel, Ben Yisrael, Ben La'akum, is that we certainly do not draw a distinction. As we said, this runs to Midos. It's not one of these areas where there is a special dispensation if someone is a member of the tribe. That the Geneva's Das, even Bidvarim alone, according to Pashup Shad, is something that appears for sure, and it's the way we would ask him to be also Ben Yisrael, Ben La'akum, just to make that clear. Yes?
Isn't that against Gemara? Isn't Gemara the favorite Shad Matana is also?
For Yisrael, yes.
The case
of Ayisari Bachaveiro says Bachaveiro. The question is whether Bachaveiro is Dafka, whether Bachaveiro is not Dafka.
What does Ali Gemara with the gift more than giving the meat in the English? Was it give the
Shmuel? Shmuel says, but there that was for a mech, that was the course of bridge. So the course of bridge, some say that's not a matana. They had to give something to the toll booth operator to enable them to pass the bridge. So that was not just a matana, otherwise they're not going to get to pass the bridge. The thing is, what they gave the person was something that appeared to be of much greater value than it really was. But that, you know, is really the Torah's method. That was the transaction that needed to be conducted so that they would be able to pass by the bridge. You have to show me which one. That's the one that was they said that Shmuel never explicitly articulated this rule. It was derived from Miklola. It was derived from a Maisa that occurred, right? So that's the case of Tarnagolas. I'm on Baye, Tarnagolas, Trefa, Havai, Biyamaniele, Mar de Shuta. But that also could be in the context of a Mecher. If you look at it, there's no indication over there that that's a case of Matana per se. Yeah. In other words, that a case where there's a mecher that takes place, like the Shulchan Aruch talks about, that's the case with the Shach quotes from Simon Kuf Yud Zayin. That's exactly the case in Kuf Yud Zayin, which the Shach quotes, where you're selling a behema trefa and you're pretending that it's a behema shuta, so you're still selling it. It's just that you're selling something which is of less of value than that which you're claiming to sell it for, but that's still a sale. Okay? All right. Fine. I mean, look at Tosfos. He also talks. He says that's the case of where it's a Kenyan. Okay. Now, the Shulchan Aruch Harav makes the suggestion that maybe the fact that the Rambam has the halakos in two different cases, in two different places, one in Hilchos Mechira and one in Hilchos Deos, that the Hilchos Mechira is really centered on Mecca for Memphir, and that's the Araisa, and Hilchos Deos, which is dealing with like the Matana cases, or the Ayisare B'chavero, and the opening up of the barrel case, so that's all Midrabanan. And then you can question, is that something which is only B'chavero, is that something which extends even beyond B'chavero? However, the reality is that it's not Mashmah that way. I think the Nishka Sain points that out as well. It's not Mashmah in the Rambam, as they mentioned, because the Rambam in Hilchos Mechira, where he's talking about the Mecca for Memphis cases, says explicitly that Afilu B'dvarim, that even if it's B'dvarim alone, it's going to be a problem of Ben Yisrael, Ben La'akum. So that's a, but leaving aside the Akum question, he does suggest that at least in terms of what's the Araisa and what's the Rabbanon, that only in a Mechachal Memphir case is it the Araisa, but otherwise it would be the Rabbanon. So if it is, let's look at from the Mechachal Memphir context, what does it mean to say that there is an Isser of Geneva's Das? If in a Mechachal Memphir context, we know that there's Geneva Mamish, if you're selling something which is not worth the price that you're selling it for, so what does Geneva's Das come to add to that existing prohibition? So the Prisha, Simon Reish Chavches, gives essentially three different answers. It gives two, but it's really three. One is that it teaches us that even if there is a stealing of money because something, piece of merchandise is being sold for less, for more than it is really worth, that there's an additional issue of Geneva's Das that the seller is telling the purchaser that it's something which is much more valuable than it really is. Just like, for example, the Shulchan Aruch says that if you commit an avla in midos and mishkalos, that you have weights and measures that are not accurate and you sell to somebody in a way in which you rip them off, is obviously an Isser Gzela, but in addition to the Isser Gzela, there's also the Isser of Los Asu Avel. There's also the Isser that you're not allowed to commit chicanery that is violated as well, so it's a double violation. Second explanation he gives, and this is very, very relevant, he says that, and this is along the lines of what the Maharshad had said in the Gemara and Hulin, sometimes what is sold might actually be sold at the fair market value. But there's a big difference in the Hakara Satov, the Maxi Tova, that the Lokath is going to have. And Lokath thinks that he's getting a $20 value and he's paying $20. And if Lokath thinks he's getting a $100 value because he claims it's from some big brand name or something like that, or this is an or this is a shoe that comes from a shuta and so forth, you think that you're getting something which is much, much more valuable. And in fact, what you're getting is not worth any more than what you're actually paying for it. So that is the type of Geneva's Das that is included even in a Mechak scenario. And the third suggestion, which he kind of carves into his second suggestion, is that you might be talking about a case where more money is charged than the value of the item, but it wouldn't be an Isser Onah because it's less than 1/6 more. But the reason that you're selling that amount, which is less than 1/6 more, is because of a false claim regarding the quality or the nature of the object. So even though there might not be an Isser Gzela or an Isser Onah in this particular case, but nonetheless, there would be an Isser of Geneva's Das, despite the fact that the price differential is less than 1/6. Interestingly enough, the Taz points out, this is in Hilchos Tiras Poalim, in Siman Shin Lamed Beis, in Siv Dalet, the Taz points out that Geneva's Das is not Mevatel Amekach. Unless the purchaser made it clear that the only reason they're buying it is because of the representation, it wouldn't be Mevatel Amekach. So if you say, oh, well, this is, I'm selling you the following pair of pants or the following suit, and this is really a, what's the name of a fancy designer, Joe Abud or something, I'm selling you a fancy designer suit, and it turns out that it's not really that fancy designer, but you sold it at the value that it was worth, so that's not going to be Mabato the Mecca. Only if the person says, I'm only buying it because I want a Joe Abud, is that the name? Whatever it is. Because I want that type of suit and only on that basis that I am buying it, so then that would be a problem. It's similar to the case over there, where somebody who is an employer hires workers at what he says is the going rate, and it turns out that the going rate is really more, so the Taz says it doesn't really matter. the going rate is not going to be controlling unless the worker has made it clear that they're only agreeing to be hired if it's consistent with the going rate. And he says it's meisim b'chol yom that you have the following trick for which it is performed, okay, where a seller says, oh, I had a lot of people who offered me this price before, but I didn't want to sell to them, but now I will sell to you at this price. And they're making up the whole thing. It's entirely fabricated. Not a single person offered that price. But only if the purchaser says, oh, well, if it's the case that others have offered you the price, well, then and only then will I buy it for you at this price. And so then they can be revatel the mecca. But if the purchaser doesn't say that, so it's known that sellers engage in puffery and in self-promotion. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it's a condition of the transaction. It's interesting that he uses the lashon that it's meisim b'chol yom. Very, very interesting. So now let's go back to the machlokes between Rav and Rav Safra. Okay. So remember we had that story where Marzutra is walking along the path and he meets up with Rav and Rav Safra. Right, he's on the way from Sakara to Mahuza, and they're on their way to Sakura to Sakara. And he thinks that they're going out to greet them, and Rav Yosef and Rav Safra says, well, we're not, but we would have had we known. And Rav says, why did you say that to him? You know, you're going to make him feel bad or whatever. And the Gemara says, well, what was wrong with you should tell the person. So the answer is no. Rav felt that it was an unwarranted assumption on the part of Mar Zitra. What was going on between Rav Safra and Rav over here? How do we understand Rav Safra's view? We essentially passing like Rav. So it's interesting because there's another maisa that is discussed specifically with Rav Safra that's brought in Maseches Derech Eretz. And the maisa over there is Rav Safra was going out for a tiyul. He's going out on a stroll. He comes across the particular chosid echad. Comes across a firm member of the neighborhood, and this person gets all gushy. Wow, Rav Safra, you came out to meet me, and that's so exciting that you are giving me this kavod. I really don't deserve it, but thank you so much for giving this kavod. And Rav Safra cuts him down to size and says, no, actually, I was just going out of town. I didn't come out to meet you. And the Talmidim of Rav Safra saw that this chassid felt very bad, that he was like misfayish, he like was embarrassed by this. So they said, why did you tell him? Now he feels bad and he feels embarrassed. So Rav Safra says, well, you don't understand the epitome of my personality is Vidova Emes Vilvovo. Remember, that's Rav Safra. It's the story in the Maseches Matos. Rav Safra epitomized the notion that everyone knew that he was Kulo Emes. So in Rav Safra's case, even if there was an unwarranted assumption, the fact that Rav Safra wouldn't say anything would indicate that it must be true. So it would be as if Rav Safra was saying, yes, indeed, I did come out explicitly to honor you, even if he didn't articulate those words based on who Rav Safra is. So this explains why this is not codified anywhere by halacha, because you'd have to be like Rav Safra. And the Maisa were not like Rav Safra. So Rav Safra says, "Kemedum alisha yisi gonei daito." So that's specifically with respect to Rav Safra. But Rav's, you know, feeling was that for other individuals who don't have that Rav Safra reputation, the silence doesn't necessarily mean acquiescence, especially in the case of an unwarranted assumption. So the question is, let's say, you know, you go to a shul dinner or something, okay? And, or you go to some yeshiva dinner. And you're going because you're there as a guest of one of the honorees, or you're there because you just feel you want to support the yeshiva, or you're there, who knows why, just because somebody asked you to go. Some fundraiser asked you to go, and you figure, okay, I'll do a tova. And then you meet one of the honorees. You didn't even know he's being honored. Maybe you saw it in the mail and didn't think twice about it, and the person says, oh, thank you for coming. You know, thank you so much for coming to honor me. So is that an unwarranted assumption that requires a correction, or is that, you know, something where, you know, you are making a specific effort to come to the dinner? It's not just like Marzutra, who's walking on the path and happens to come across Safra and Rava, who could have been going anywhere, was an unwarranted inference. Would there be an obligation to correct under those circumstances? So this is the type of scenario which is discussed. My own personal feeling is that probably Rava Shita would still be controlling, because precisely for the reason that I said, that people do go to number one. people go to dinners for all kinds of reasons. And number two, this is etiquette. If you're an honoree at a dinner and you see somebody, you've got to think of something to say. It's like a nice thing to say. You're being honored. The person says, thank you for coming to dinner and thank you for showing honor. The fact that they're there is showing honor. Whether it was with kavana or whether it wasn't with kavana, it's not necessarily the case that an honoree at the dinner who even says that line is working with the assumption that the person only came for their benefit. It's just a proper type of etiquette, a type of a social statement to make in that context when coming across somebody. The Maisa, they're there. The Maisa is being honored. So I don't think that anything needs to be corrected. If anything, the rubber principle would come into play that correcting it is almost like you're saying exactly the opposite. No, I would never come here to honor you. And I want you to be very, very clear about that. I don't think that the Geneva's Das interdiction requires that type of clarification in such a scenario. The other thing to say about Rastafra is that the notion of being so sure that you would have done this favor anyway is not necessarily something that anybody can say. Remember, the Lechem Mishnah had pointed out that the Rambam left out this explanation or this scenario or this possibility in the case of the opening up of the barrel, that the Gemara says, oh, well, maybe it would have been okay for Rav Yehuda to open up the barrel for Ula, even though it was already consigned to a merchant, because it's the sort of thing that he would do anyway for Ula. So the Leib Aryeh says, you know why this is not codified la halacha? It's not codified, and Rabbi Levin Levin quotes the Leib Aryeh in a couple of places as well. The Leib Aryeh says it's not codified la halacha because din zeh lo shayach b'stam b'nei adam she midas b'nei adam he she b'libo misave taba ligmo chesed li'ov overeo. That when it's all theoretical and hypothetical, yes, of course you want to do good things to everybody. So the person then fools himself in his mind. They say that even if it would cause him a loss, he still would have done it anyway. But when it actually comes to the situation itself to perform the act of chesed, and there really could be a loss, then there's much more of a likelihood that in the final analysis, this hypothetical tova will not end up being a realistic tova. So it's a very interesting insight and comment about human nature that the Leib Aryeh makes. He says that's why we don't postulate this way. We don't postulate that you can rely upon a hypothetical self-assessment. So he asked the question based on one of the tshuvas that I had brought in the materials, the Igros Moshe, Chelik Tzir Yoredea, Chelik Beis, Simon Samach Aleph, where the Igros Moshe seems to postulate in a way which is contrary a little bit to the simple reading of the halacha in Siman Reish Chaf Ches based on the Gemara in Bava Metzia. Ein mefachasin lo adam v'lo beim v'lo kelim. We don't color, okay, people. Kigon tzvo azatan eved omei linko, like you color the beard of an eved who's being sold. Kidei shiyer kebachor, so he'll look younger. V'la ashkos v'ema mei supin, or to make an animal look fatter and healthier than the animal really is. You want to, you know, dress up a youngster to look better, or, you know, a nice looking animal to look even nicer. So that's okay. That's, you know, makeup. That's Hollywood. That's all right. But to conduct a completely false impression is something which is awesome. So Rav Moshe and the quotes of Levush Mordechai and a couple of others, Rav Moshe himself quotes, who agreed with him, Rav Eliezer Meir Prale, who all said that if you have somebody who's in the workforce and they go prematurely gray, if you can imagine such a thing, now they're having a hard time getting a job, or they're afraid they're not going to be hired, but they know that they're just as good as anybody else their age, that they are allowed to dye their hair. He has a discussion about the Begadisha, you know, why it's not a problem with that, and so forth and so forth. So he asks, but isn't this also engaging in dangerous self-assessment? you're assessing that you're going to be able to do as good a job as anybody else. Why is that more reliable than this type of self-assessment that the Leib Aryeh says cannot be relied upon? So he says that the difference is that a person kind of knows themselves in terms of their workability. This isn't a hypothetical thing. If they would be 30 years old, would they be as good as any other 30-year-old? They are 30 years old. They know how good they are. But that's not a question of what type of altruistic deed might I conduct or not conduct in a hypothetical situation that has not occurred yet. So he says that there is a distinction that we have to draw between the situations that are much more closer and nearer and capable of self-assessment to somebody that relate to the things that they do right now on a daily basis, and those types of self-assessment that relate to an act of chesed, where there could be a monetary loss, where it hasn't actually come into fruition yet, where that's not something that could be relied upon. Sort of an interesting distinction in this regard, but one that I think certainly has validity. And he says, in general, you have to make these type of reasonable assessments, even if you look at, for example, the case of the Gemara, where there was where you have the announcement, the Hachrazah, Nafal Bistra Livnei Chela, that the Gemara says that's not considered to be a misleading type of statement when you say that there's a meat that's out there in the marketplace, even though the word treif basa, even though the fact that it's treif meat wasn't explicitly mentioned, and the Gemara says, yeah, because everybody kind of understands what it is. So he says as well that you have to look at sort of a reasonableness quotient of what people consider to be a reasonable type of assumption to make and a reasonable type of terminology to use. A number of writers, a number of contemporary business and halakha writers and poskim all talk about, for example, the following scenario, where our seller has an item that isn't selling so well, okay? And therefore, they want to mark down the price, all right? So they say this is a bargain deal. So many of the commentators say it's a bargain deal when you have to mark down the price because the regular price simply isn't selling. So that's not an accurate thing. Then you're indicating that the higher price is really the appropriate price, and this is a bargain price. Really, you just marked it down to what the market can bear at this point in time. On the other hand, to say that you're conducting an unwanted merchandise sale probably is not going to attract any customers, and it would be like nuffle trefasla bishoka. So you use a terminology where everybody kind of gets it, but at the same time, they're not going to be repulsed by the merchandise. You say we're having a clearance sale, for example, okay? So it's improper to say it's a bargain sale when it's not. You don't have to say it's an unwanted merchandise sale, but you can say something like it's a clearance. This is my terminology. You can say it's a clearance sale or something like that. So you have to, work within, the kind of reasonable inferences that people are going to make within the marketplace. I remember that when I was an attorney, so I, at one point in time, I had a client who was working on some transaction where we were doing, I don't remember exactly, maybe it was a merger of different companies, but we were dealing with a jewelry company, like a customized jewelry company. And I was learning about the business, and I was going to the store because I had to look at all the merchandise and understand how things work. I noticed that everything was constantly marked down, like there was nothing that ever sold for the actual price. So I said, do you ever sell it for this price? Like, does this price mean anything? Or is it always like for the lower value? So this woman who was the executive of the company said, no, that's the way the industry works. We always make up prices, and then this way people feel like they're getting a bargain because, we say, oh, look, it's 40% off, it's 30%. Of course you never sell for the actual price. So I don't know that halakha would look upon that so favorably. So that's, essentially what the problem would be with this type of an advertising ploy. Okay. There's another case that's not quoted lahalakha in the Shulchan Aruch, but it is quoted lahalakha. Interestingly, the Shari Tshuva brings this, and the later postgame, like the Sfarim, like Mishnah Sfarim, the Sfarim that collect the Gnevus Das cases, they bring this case as well. Pesachoshen, they bring this case. They bring the case of the Yerushalmi. Yerushalmi and Makos talks about a Talmud Chacham goes to a city, and he knows one Masechta, And he's honored for knowing two mesechtos. So the Talmud Yerushalmi says he's obligated to correct this misconception. He has to make it clear that he really only knows one mesechta and doesn't know two mesechtos. So he says, so why is it that this is considered to not be Ihu de'adu anafshayu? Why do we not say, asks Rabbi Levine, that this is like the Mazutra case, who just had an unfounded assumption that the rabbis were coming out to honor him? Why do we say that this is a case where the it's somehow going to be that this is a misleading assumption that the Talmud Chacham actually has to correct? So Keita's explanation is that it's not so unreasonable for Balabatim to come to the conclusion that if a Talmud Chacham knows one Masechta and one Masechta quotes Sugyos and other Masechtos and so forth, that it means that the other Masechta or the Sugyos from the other Masechta that he might be citing is an indication that he's gone through that entire Masechta. So because that's a reasonable inference for people to make, it's follows a reasonable man's standard. So therefore, that's something that needs to be corrected. So whenever you have, based on the reasonable man's standard, that it's reasonable for somebody to come to this inference, it was unreasonable for Mazutra to think that he just happens to meet somebody in the road, that person is coming to honor him. But once you're in the reasonable territory, so that's something that needs to be corrected. It's interesting, I thought Pispei Foshia just has a passing comment in which he says that he doesn't think that the Talmud Chacham has to correct the misconception in the event that it's going to cause them to be mebazeh him. He says, you know, that there is a requirement to avoid receiving excessive kavod. In fact, that's what some of the other poskim, like Rabbi Tzvi Spitz says this, some of the other poskim say the problem in the Yerushalmi case is that they're giving him, it's not just that they say, we're impressing, you know, two mesechtos. They're giving him a parking space in the shul because he knows two mesechtos as opposed to one. That he's getting a tangible honor on that basis, and you can't receive a tangible honor for something which is untrue. So this devotion says, you're also not obligated to receive a demotion based on their conception that this is something that you know should know, even though it's not something necessarily that is necessary for you to know. So if they have an impression that you know multiple mesechtos because they just think that that's a barometer by which to measure a qualified rav, and you put them in their place because you're honest, and most people wouldn't necessarily be so honest to say, oh, well, I haven't mastered every single tosros. So that's not necessarily what they have in mind. They say, oh, you don't know. So now we're going to demote you. Now we realize you're not such a chashev rav. So he doesn't think that in that type of a community, if it would lead to that sort of result, that it would be necessary for the Talmud Chacham to show off his modesty, shall we say. So I thought that was just an interesting comment. So anyway, based on this reasonable man standard, so Rabbi Levine has the chiddush that he thinks that any advertising agency is obligated to pilot test their advertising copy, that in order to see how reasonable people interpret the representations that are made to make sure that there are not mistaken inferences that are derived. Okay? Alright. Now, one other thing that the Gemara mentions a couple of places, and therefore it's important to just note as part of the Geneva's Das discussion, is that there is a kavod consideration that even though it is improper to be misbarev, to exhort somebody to come and be a guest in your home when you know that they're not going to come and that's the only reason that you're doing it, sometimes even if you know that somebody can't make it, the Gemara says that Mishim Kavod, the Smart quotes this in Shulchan Aruch as well, that if you're doing it because otherwise it would be an embarrassment, that you're not inviting someone. Like, you know someone can't come, but you're inviting other people to come to some party or board or whatever in your house. You know this person can't come, but if you don't explicitly say to him, oh, I'd like you to come too, he's just going to be embarrassed in the presence of the others. If he doesn't receive an invitation as well, he's going to be embarrassed compared to the others. So then, of course, he says it's appropriate to do it. He just shouldn't be overly gushy about it. You know, he shouldn't be matzir when you know the person's not going to come. But to extend an invitation, of course, that is correct. Further application of that is that where the Gemara with the Shulchan Aruch, based on the Gemara, talks about lo yomar lo soch shemen mipapadev u reikon. shouldn't say to somebody, oh, I have a flask of oil, and you can anoint yourself with some oil, when in fact the flask is empty. And you shouldn't go to a base of oil with an empty flask, because with an empty jar of food or whatever it was. And the oil thinks that it's full of food or wine, whatever the item is. But if it's done in order to be mechavid, then it's mutter. And the Sema says something very interesting. Now, you're not making a representation when you walk in with a vessel to the oil's house that there's anything in the vessel. It might not be anything in the vessel. Maybe you're just doing it to be mechavid. That's what we call chavir here. Everybody else is there honoring him with a vessel, so you bring a vessel to it. It's like, you know, you're davening. All these laws, as the Shari Tshuva says, are based on some level on the Alachta Bidrachov. So it's like, you know, you're davening and you want to show cover to a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Everyone's saying Shema, so you cover your eyes. You're not actually saying Shema, but, you know, it's a cover here type of thing. That everyone else is showing cover, you should show cover too, even if you're not actually saying the Shema at that point in time. And so you can, you know, extend it to these types of cases. But the Shema says, but to actually say, oh, go anoint yourself with some oil from this flask and the flask is empty, that you can't do. So when we say Mishum Kavod, you could do it, that's when there is some flask. You know that he's not going to accept the oil, but you have some oil in there. You don't have some oil, so then you have no right to do it. So I thought that, we probably don't have so much time to get into this. I thought that this could be the explanation of a difficult Rambam, just briefly, and the Rambam is carried over to the Shulchan Aruch too, and Hilchos Mechira, where the Rambam talks about mixing a certain type of high-quality yayin with lower-quality yayin. So he says that if it's the type of thing with nikar tamo, where you'd be able to taste the fact that there was a dilution, so then it would be permissible. But then, when the Rambam talks about mixing yayin with mayin, he says if everybody tasted it, it would be okay, but he doesn't say nikar tamo. So the Lechem Mishnah says, yeah, because it wasn't done so much, the Rambam doesn't give that scenario. But of course, nikar tamo would be the same thing. And Shulchan Aruch also carries over this distinction of Rambam. So I was thinking, maybe within the Rambam as well, the Rambam was going along these lines. That if it's you're selling something as yayin, and you have high quality yayin and lower quality yayin, so then if there's a standard that people usually mix to a certain degree, or you could discern the degree of the mixing. So it's not mama sheker that you're selling the yayin, but if I'm selling the yayin and I mix mayim in it, that's mama sheker. So then, unless everybody's mamish going to actually sample it beforehand, so that's something that would not be permissible, even if it was nikar tamo. So I thought that could be a possible yishuv in the Rambam. So now let's talk about some of the potential applications. All right. Now, one, halacha l'maaseh, cheating on exams. So Rav Moshe Feinstein in Kosher Mishpacha had a base on Siman Lamed. Lamed says you can't cheat on exams. Okay. Why can't Lamed says why can't you cheat on exams? Because number one, it's Ganevus Mammon, because when you get certain marks on exams, then you're going to get a better job than somebody else because you got those jobs. So you're cheating the person who didn't, you're taking away money from the person who didn't cheat on the exam by virtue of the fact that you're representing yourself as a better student. And of course, he says it's Ganevus Das. That goes without question. And if he makes a comment over here, that is, I think, you know, a very, very, instructive comment. He says that, says you're spending the time of studying, you know, what are you doing? It's rimana shach. If you're not going to take it seriously, so then it's mamash bitul zman. If you're doing it, you have to do it right. So you're going to spend the time studying. You better really master the material. Otherwise, it's going to be bitul zman. You're going to spend time learning. You spend time in secular studies, so you'll get a profession, and you're not going to focus on what you're studying. So what's the point of it? It's the point. There's absolutely no point to doing it. So I thought it was a very interesting comment that Rav Moshe made as part of this discussion. He also says that once a person is accepted who's a Ben Torah, so there's an assumption that the Ben Torah did well in his grades, that he's a real Ben Torah in every single way. So then when he's working in his parnas, he's working in his workplace, and somehow there's another coworker, and things aren't going properly, not going properly because he never learned the material, so the boss is going to assume that it's all the fault of the other guy, because he'll assume that a Ben Torah has impeccable credentials, and is impeccable in everything that he does, and he'll blame the other person. So therefore, it's a very interesting number, and we talked about it with Geneva, but the way in which he assumes that the Geneva would play out tells you something about what the expectations are to be a Ben Torah. There's also a similar tshuva in the Mishnah Halachos. The Mishnah Halachos goes from an opposite direction. That's what Menashe Klein, Zichron Levacha. So Menashe Klein says, kind of goes in the direction of, I don't want to give the impression by answering this Shaila that I'm endorsing college. And so, you know, that's kind of, he says, I'm in Megala Tefach and Mechasitz Vachayim. not a fan of college, but he says if you're going to college for a job, so then it's Kenevis Mammon. If you're not going for a job, you're just going for a diploma so that, you know, people will think well of you, you'll satisfy your in-laws or whatever, that you got a diploma, your parents, that you got a diploma, but it's not for purposes of getting a job. So then he says that it would be a problem of Kenevis Das. He has a lashon who like Tachos Mizeh, but I'm not going to touch that. So the when he gets quoted, nobody quotes that part for good reason. Now, and who knows what he meant. When I was a student at Yeshiva College, I used to work on the commentator. And my year of the commentator, we had a very fine staff. And one of the people who used to write a lot of articles was Rabbi Aaron Cohn, who's now a rabbi in Pesach. And he wrote a whole article about a cheating problem at YU. Because he had a whole issue which was devoted to at that time. Hopefully it's been rectified since then. Poll shows widespread cheating. And there were articles all over the entire newspaper about this and so forth. Rabbi Cohn quoted so lovely classical sources. He quoted the Rav Moshe. He quoted Rav Menashe Klein. But he also threw in one other consideration, which I thought, you could see, in those days I used to do illustrations for the commentators here. I have an illustration of students cheating from each other until the last one actually looks at the teacher. I think it was Dr. Willie. You can only see it, like it's a little small, but it's a good picture. So he was one of my professors as well. So he points out that there's also something else that's done with respect to exams, which is that there are curves. And based on how a student performs on the exam, could throw the curve in an opposite direction. So that somebody who got, say, a 75 on the exam, but maybe they would have gotten an A because, nobody else got in the 90s, and therefore the curve would have been allocated completely differently. Now that somebody got in the 90s because they cheated, so now the curve is going to be allocated in the detriment of this other student. They'll end up getting a much worse grade, and that worse grade could be the difference of them getting into a good graduate school or not, and then getting a good job and not getting a good job, and can affect their entire life and career. So there are, in many, many different ways, a serious actual ramifications, both on a Gnevis Das level, in terms of Midos, and in terms of being Maksa Tova Bechidim, and on a Gnevis Mammon level as well. The Rav Moshe also, right next to that Shuvah, has a Shuvah, I think this is Choftes, Chelet based on Simon Choftes of Choshe Mishpat, about whether it's appropriate for a school to cheat on regents. So Rav Moshe says that it would be the same sort of problem, but he says also for a school to lie about how many students they have and so forth in order to get more benefits from the government. So he points out that is a gezel, it's cause of its gnevus das, it's kol Hashem, it would cause his rodei tamnei chachamim to be besmirched in public. It's a violation of Dina de Malchus de Dina, and he says, what type of chinuch are you teaching your children? What's the whole purpose of the chinuch? It's to teach the highest standards. So if you're doing that, it defeats the entire purpose of education. The Sicily Ezer in Chelik Tesvav Sidman Yud Beis talks about in order to get a good job in the medical field, apparently they have to write articles, and you shouldn't make up medical data so that you can get your articles published, which he says as well could cost people jobs because the person who's making up the data will get a better job than the person who's not making up the data. These things are, obviously they almost go without saying. Nonetheless, it's important to say them anyway. With respect to the last halacha that's in Sidur Reish Chaf Tes points out that storekeepers are allowed to get an advantage through gimmicks and freebies. And the reason for that, the Aruch HaShulchan explains, is that because they're not deceptive practices per se. These are things that any merchant would be able to do, even if you drive down the price in order to attract customers. But the Aruch HaShulchan does say, and this is something that, Yetz Hashem, if we get into Hasagas Gvul at any point, the Aruch HaShulchan does say that when you drive down prices, it can't be predatory in nature. It has to be a price that the market could bear and that other merchants would be able to sell for as well. It can't be an unrealistic price that somebody with billions of dollars of assets could sell at a ridiculous price in order to put other people out of business and then bring back the item to its normal price after the other competitors have been put out of business. It has to be a type, just like every single merchant has the ability to give out nuts and candies to the kids. So it has to be a type of price that every single merchant would be able to lower the item to that price according to what the market could normally bear. Others bring examples of you shouldn't exploit money back offers. I saw an article by Rabbi Yeshua Pfeffer that there are people who will just constantly buy items where it says a satisfaction guarantee, they'll get your money back, and they'll just get the money back for everything. So, you know, these are all contemporary issues of Gnevas Das. I'll just finish with a relevant thought regarding the Inyan of Yom. It's no longer, I guess we're reaching the end of Hanukkah at this week. When we started, it was probably a little bit before Shkita, now it's probably at the end. But we started the show with Zos Hanukkah, which, why do we call the eighth day of Hanukkah Zos Hanukkah? Because we read Zos Hanukkah as Hanukkah. But the Sfas Emes explains, because it represents the entirety of Hanukkah. Why does it represent the entirety of Hanukkah? Because Tovach Ristavar Meresh Yisrael. Because at the end of the matter, as we know, is sweeter than at the beginning when you've done things right. And I think that's very much, you know, the message that we wanted to relay over here as well, in terms of not cheating on exams to get ahead and so forth. That the end is sweet, we believe, from a halakhic perspective, when you don't take the attitude of, oh, well, the end justifies the means, when the means are proper as well. When we celebrate at the end that we did the means correctly, just like the Chashmonaim, we're not compromised at all in terms of the way they would perform the mitzvah. They did it with Higgumis and Mahadim and Hadim and Shem and Torah and so forth. The means have to be perfect. We have to live that way. We have to aspire to do everything in the perfect fashion in terms of our midos, in terms of our hanhagos, in terms of our professional and personal integrity. And then, you know, Mitzvah Shem will always be able to celebrate that we have lived our lives according to the proper means, you know, all the way up to the end.
Okay,
next week on Thursday.
Right, December 24th. I think I'm on, right?
Should yeah, be. I don't remember who.
Okay, so then we have nothing else after that. On this. We'll have to discuss after that. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, the thing that's already too late, it's very fine.